You're listening to Central Time here on the Ideas Network. I'm Rob Ferret. Coming up, we'll talk about the history of humanity's most dangerous predator, the mosquito. Now in the Bahamas, first responders and aid workers are still struggling to help the places hit hardest by Hurricane Dorian. A week ago, the massive storm devastated the islands of Abaco and Grand Bahama. Christy Delafield is Director of Communications for the global humanitarian organization Mercy Corps. We reached her earlier today on Grand Bahama Island. Christy, thanks for joining us.
Thanks so much for having me.
Can you describe for us what the devastation on the two islands looks like at this point?
Absolutely. Mercy Corps' team visited Abaco Island a couple of days ago, and I was able to go with them. That island is nearly totally destroyed. The winds and rains that came from Hurricane Dorian as it sat over the two islands for about 48 hours just leveled homes, businesses, buildings. At this point, almost everyone has been evacuated from that island. Here where I am now on Grand Bahama in Freeport, things fared a little bit better. The buildings and infrastructure were a little bit better, but there's still very little cell phone service, no electricity, and most places do not have running water.
And are there still people who have not been evacuated from Grand Bahama?
Absolutely. There's been some evacuation from Grand Bahama, but not nearly on the level that we're seeing in, off of Abaco. People are kind of trying to stay here, repair their homes a little bit. As you drive around, everyone's got furniture, clothes out in their yard, drying in the sun. There are long lines at gas stations as people are trying to get fuel for a generator or for their vehicle. If their vehicle still runs, the flooding was so severe that many people's cars were damaged and are now inoperable.
What are the biggest priorities right now, both for the people still on the islands and the people who have been evacuated to other islands in the Bahamas?
Well, back in Nassau, there are various shelters being set up. Here on Grand Bahama, Mercy Corps is really focused on getting clean water to people, food where we can do it, all of the things that you might imagine, tarps, rope, things that people would need to repair homes and shelters. There are additional thunderstorms coming in this weekend, so we're a little bit concerned about people whose roofs aren't quite ready to have another storm. And one of the unexpected things that you might not imagine being helpful in a disaster is Mercy Corps bringing in solar lanterns that have little USB chargers so people can charge their phones, contact their loved ones, get information about where supplies are being distributed, and also contact emergency services.
And they're lanterns, so they give light when the electrical infrastructure is down, an added bonus there.
Absolutely. Absolutely. It's very dark at night here, so it provides a little bit of light, maybe a little bit of greater feeling of safety and security, which is really important after a disaster, you can imagine.
And I read, I think it was on the Mercy Corps website, there are immediate needs in the recovery, but this is a recovery that's not going to be done in days, weeks, maybe even months, right?
Absolutely. This actually has an eerie resemblance to what I saw in Puerto Rico, and Mercy Corps' team is still in Puerto Rico 2 years later, and I wouldn't be surprised if it were similar here. The level of destruction is just so significant. So in this emergency phase, we're really focused on getting people those supplies that they need right away, but that we're also looking towards the future and thinking about what the long-term recovery needs to be like. And so we're contacting local organizations and trying to understand what we can do to support them as they prepare for that next phase.
Talking to Christy Delafield from Mercy Corps, looking at the latest news and recovery efforts in the Bahamas, especially the most affected islands after the hurricane slowly passed over them. Christy, can you describe in a little more detail the damage that stalled hurricane did and the different risks that posed to the people there?
There are two key types of damage that we're seeing. There's the wind damage. And I mean, you just wouldn't believe it. One car thrown on top of another. We saw a boat on top of a two-story building on Abaco Island. Roofs ripped off, windows blown out. And then the second type of damage is from the flooding. Anywhere from 18 inches to 8 feet of floodwaters rushed over this city, and people's homes were just completely inundated. So anytime you have that level of flooding, the water, it's salt water, first of all, and then it can become contaminated with toxins, whatever else it's picked up and is carrying around becomes infused in the things that it touches. So we saw a dentist office where they lost tens of thousands of dollars worth of equipment. We've seen homes that have been completely destroyed. And you can see the water line on the wall of how high those floodwaters were.
What is it going to take to not just, again, meet these immediate needs, but to rebuild, for people to move in, reopen businesses, things like that? That is not a quick fix, it sounds like.
It's not. And it's going to start with a little bit of kind of muck and gut, where people are just pulling out debris, sorting out what's salvageable, what isn't. People are drying things out, can be dried out. They're trying to figure out if equipment can be restarted. A big part of the repair and recovery is testing electrical lines, because once those floodwaters have gone in, if that's compromised your electrical lines, there's risk of fire, there's risk of injury, and we really want to be sure, not me personally, right, but the authorities want to be certain that people are safe and that where possible they're going to have to go in and repair electrical lines in homes and offices and public buildings.
Now, tragically, I understand over 40 people are confirmed to have died as a result of the hurricane, and the government is still assessing who is missing. What do we know about those latest efforts?
Well, there are different numbers floating around. What we do know is that there are at least several thousand people who have been unaccounted for, and it's not clear what's happened to them. Any loss of life is a tragedy in this situation, and we're really concerned that those numbers might be rising as the authorities get more information.
Now, some people, as you mentioned, were evacuated elsewhere in the Bahamas. The United States is pretty close. There were some ferries, I understand. What do we know about people seeking at least temporary shelter in the United States?
Well, we certainly encourage the United States to issue visa waivers or exemptions for people who are trying to seek safety in the United States. I don't know the exact numbers of where people are going. I think that the largest numbers are certainly going to shelters in Nassau, and that they're ramping up a response there to provide shelter for people and other support, food, water, you name it.
Now, people here in Wisconsin are probably looking to help. I'm sure a lot of people will be. I've talked to other people who do disaster relief work who say donating in kind, donating things like clothing or water, things like that, not always the best answer. What do you say to people who are thinking about making a donation?
I think that the fastest, easiest, and best way to help is to give cash. I think that in-kind donations are fantastic for local organizations in your community where you can easily get them to those organizations and you know they're needed. In a response like this, where logistics are so challenging and we're trying to move things onto two islands, the airspace is dangerously overcrowded. It's really tricky. The best thing that people can do is give cash. And if you want to learn more or give to our relief efforts, you can visit www.mercycorps.org.
Christy, I'll let you get back to working with your team there. Thank you so much for joining us today.
Thank you for having me.
That's Christy Delafield, Communications Director for Mercy Corps. We talked to her today about the state of Hurricane Dorian disaster relief in the Bahamas. Coming up, we'll hear about a group of teenagers who came up with a device to search for a meteorite at the bottom of Lake Michigan. Stay with us here on Central Time. You're listening to Central Time. I'm Rob Ferret. Imagine being tasked with finding marble-sized pieces of a meteorite, wait, at the bottom of Lake Michigan. Scientists and some teenage volunteers are on the hunt not too far from Manitowoc. Learn all about it coming up. Right now it's time for Wisconsin Life. Here's producer Maureen McCollum with a story about divided families.
There's a summer camp near Plymouth that reunites siblings that have been separated by the foster care system. Some of these brothers and sisters haven't seen each other in years. WPR's Alana Watson spent time with the campers and co-directors to learn more about the experience.
Act like a chow! Act like a ching-ching! Chow, chow, chow! Woo!
Groups of siblings sit around a large campfire sharing stories and eating snacks. They're making memories that will have to last them until they see each other again. And for some, that could be for a whole year.
Can I do it?
Yes, I'll do it.
Welcome to Camp Tubalong, Wisconsin. It's a week-long summer camp dedicated to reuniting siblings who are separated by the foster care system, giving them a place to create bonds they never had the opportunity to make.
There's
over 8,000 kids in foster care right now in the state of Wisconsin, and 50 to 75% of those kids are separated from at least one of their siblings.
That is Kate Bauer. Her and her husband Rob are co-directors of Camp Tubalong, Wisconsin. They've been involved with the national nonprofit since 1998 and eventually decided to bring the camp back home. Their first official camp was in 2015, reuniting 30 siblings. This year, they brought 59 siblings together for a week of activities like horseback riding and gaga ball. There's also one-on-one time through family picnics and birthday parties. Rob Bauer is a soft-spoken social worker and says he and Kate make sure each sibling feels welcomed and cared for.
We create a sense of family here that we strive for, and I think the kids really buy into that.
Camp Tubalong, Wisconsin may seem like a typical summer camp, and for the most part it is, but you can only imagine the emotions that flow through the campground.
When they said bye and stuff, like, I didn't know that was going to be the last day we've seen them for 6 years.
Meet Vanity. She was reunited with four of her five siblings for the first time in 6 years at Camp Tubalong.
And when I first heard about it, it was like, it filled a hole in my heart. I was so happy.
When her and her siblings first got to camp, they locked arms, sat together, and drew a circle around themselves. Throughout the week, they were inseparable.
I liked when we sat down and like ate pizza and just talked about how we felt in life.
Oh, yeah.
That was really fun.
Vanity says getting that simple opportunity to talk to her siblings has given her part of her life back.
It just, like, I can imagine not having these guys. Like, my life would not be the same.
This is one of the main aspects of Camp Tubalong, Wisconsin: emotional empowerment. They give the campers a space to share their experiences, express concerns, and to feel recognized. It also gives them the opportunity to just be a kid.
They grow up way too fast in a very scary world for them, and they want to protect each other as siblings. And they're just kids.
Kate Bauer says the sibling relationship is generally one of the strongest and longest relationships that a person has in their lifetime, and they're able to reconnect those relationships in a week.
I know for some of you it's been really hard. Probably a lot of you. It's been hard for us too.
As camp comes to an end, everyone gathers around a campfire to reflect on the week. Some campers remain silent and listen. Others express their appreciation. A few make jokes. Most have tears in their eyes as they prepare to say goodbye to their family. They don't know when they'll see their brothers and their sisters again, but they hope they'll see each other later in the place where they belong.
They're just kids who want to be loved, just like any other kid. And they're kids who just want to belong. And that's what we try to do here.
WPR's Alana Watson brought us that story. Tune in later this week to meet more of the siblings at Camp Tubalong, Wisconsin. Wisconsin Life is a co-production of Wisconsin Public Radio and Wisconsin Public Television in partnership with the Wisconsin Humanities Council. Additional support comes from Lowell and Mary Peterson of Appleton. Find more Wisconsin Life at wisconsinlife.org and on Facebook. I'm Maureen McCollum.
Now, you might remember a meteorite that made headlines in Wisconsin a couple years ago. It lit up the skies over the Midwest. It was captured on dash cams and cell phone cameras. It wound up crashing into Lake Michigan about 10 miles from shore, somewhere between Manitowoc and Sheboygan. By this point, meteorites tend to be little tiny pieces, so imagine trying to find them 200 feet below the surface of the water. A group of scientists and teenage volunteers at the Adler Planetarium in Chicago came up with an idea: build a magnetic sled that skids along the bottom of the lake and picks up iron, which meteorites are mostly made of, as I understand it. They've made some test runs with it the last couple of years, and they're talking now about what they've found. Chris Bresky is the teen programs coordinator at the Adler Planetarium. Chris, welcome to Central Time.
Thank you so much for having us.
And Jack Morgan's a teen participant with Project Aquarius, the code name of this particular meteorite hunt. Jack, thanks a lot for coming into the studios of WBEZ.
Well, it's great to be here.
Well, Chris, first off, take us to astronomy class. Remind us what a meteorite is.
Sure. So you can, like, let's think of the visualize outside Earth's orbit. So big, it's everything that we're talking about here is a rock from space. Outside the Earth's orbit, think of it as an asteroid. It enters our orbit, it becomes a meteor. Once it lands on the ground, now it's a meteorite. All jargon for the same space rock.
And what can we learn? Why are we so excited to find these fragments and learn about what's out beyond orbit there?
Well, every single meteorite has a story locked within it of the birth of our solar system, rocks older than what the Earth is made out of. So that's really exciting, anything that we can find here on Earth. So every single rock that falls to Earth is a time capsule, holds with it a story. What's even more exciting about this one is that because so much video recording was made of it, our astronomer over at the Adler Planetarium, Mark Hammergren, was able to track its path back out into its original orbit in the main asteroid belt. So we find a piece of this meteorite. We find a puzzle piece of the makeup of our solar system. And less than 30 meteors in the history of astronomy have that much data. So this is pretty exciting.
Now, Jack, how did you get on board with this meteorite hunt?
Well, I initially started at the Adler Planetarium on a completely different program that I found online through a summer program site because I was looking for something to do over the summer between.
Your mom said, "Don't do nothing," right?
Yeah, basically. I had to get out of the house one summer and do something, and I found a program at the planetarium. And then on the second to last day, Chris walked in and was like, "Oh, hey, tomorrow we're testing a prototype of our magnetic sled." And then we were all just sort of like, wait, what?
What?
And he explained to us the basics of the project. It was in its first year. And I signed up right away and haven't looked back since.
Yep.
Chris, where did this idea for a magnetic sled on the floor of Lake Michigan come from?
Right. The wild thing about a rock that falls into Lake Michigan, the Adler Planetarium knows a lot about space rocks, but doesn't know a lot about the lake. But luckily, our museum is right next door to the Shedd Aquarium, and there are marine biologists there. And there are also meteorite experts at the Field Museum next door to that. So talking to marine biologists over at the Shedd Aquarium, they quickly told us how beneficial underwater sleds can be for underwater exploration. And they're commonly used. So they said, well, you're looking for something underwater? Try using a sled.
And Jack, what do you and other teen volunteers do on Project Aquarius?
I mean, everything.
Yeah, pretty much. We've the teens that came before me on the project were the ones who actually pretty much did the designing and the building of the sled. And then my group came along and we were designing sensors that we would send down to the bottom of the lake to figure out what the environment was down there, because we had no idea and we kind of needed to know that to know what shape our meteorites would be in by the time we found them. And that happened through the first winter of the project, and then summer came along and it was time to take our sled out onto the lake and give it its first run.
Yeah, he's been on board for several deployments following the sled down to what Jack was saying, these unknown depths. Less than 1% of the Great Lakes have been mapped in detail. And so when their sled was deployed into this new area, they actually were exploring uncharted territories.
Cool.
They were going into a new frontier.
Well, I understand there's other bits of iron that you could find at the floor of the Great Lakes. Why is that, Chris?
Well, Jack knows too.
Yes.
Yeah, Jack, what are you finding down there?
Oh, so much. So much and yet so little. Well, the first thing that we discovered was that there is a layer of magnetite sediment on the bottom of Lake Michigan that gets stuck to our magnets.
There are iron-rich mountains just north of the lakes. Some in Wisconsin, too, in the Iron Range. And so, the glaciers carved off and gave us a nice iron-rich sand sediment layer, which is fun to pick up.
Yeah. And then we went down to the bottom of the lake, and we initially expected it to be a, you know, smooth, sandy bottom with maybe the occasional patches of the invasive mussel species, the quagga mussels. And instead, it was the complete opposite. It was just a bed of nothing but mussels with only occasional clear spots.
Yeah.
And the mussels are filter feeders, which means they suck in that magnetite and iron filings that end up in the water, and they become magnetized.
Yep. Magnetic mussels.
So we pulled up the sled for the first time, and the magnets were covered in mussels.
Oh, no.
It was like we were dredging up something that had been left to rot down there, and the mussels had taken up root.
Yeah.
One heck of a cleanup operation on the first day.
Alien invaders of a different kind.
I mean, you're doing the glamour work, Jack, scraping mussels off the magnetic sled.
Yes, I'm so glad our boat had a pressure washer. Just spray them off. Just, yeah. But it's always interesting. And, of course, because you can't be 100% you can't be 100% with getting those muscles off. Some of them ended up in our collection bins, and they were sitting unrefrigerated in the basement of the Adler for about a month, and then we cracked them open. And let's just say the other people working there that day did not enjoy the fact that we did that in the break room.
All right, have we struck meteorite yet, guys?
I can't officially tell you that we have struck meteorite, but I can say that we have some very strong candidates that we're working with our friends at the field to analyze in the next week or so.
And I understand you're both going to be talking about Project Aquarius, a moderating discussion at the Manitowoc Maritime Museum this Saturday. We'll give the time in a bit. But what can people expect? I think you're both going to be there, right?
That's right.
Yes.
Yeah. And some of the scientists there, too. Another one of our teen participants. And you'll get to meet the stars, Jack, and the scientists who've been on this journey, see some of the content, and see some of the tools that they've built.
Can we smell some of those expired mussels at this presentation?
You bet we can. We'll bring a bucket just for you.
Oh, and I should ask Chris, for people if they can't make it to Manitowoc, is there a good way to follow along with your efforts at Project Aquarius?
Oh, absolutely. You can go on the Adler Planetarium website. There's a whole page devoted to the Aquarius Project. And there's also an Aquarius Project podcast. All the amazing, unexpected, non-scientist people who've joined the efforts and made this reality. The story is pretty exciting.
Well, thanks to both of you for joining us today.
Thanks for having us.
Oh, thanks. It's great to be here.
I've been talking to Chris Bresky, Teen Programs Coordinator at the Adler Planetarium in Chicago, and Jack Morgan, teen member of Project Aquarius. They've been looking for tiny meteorite fragments at the bottom of Lake Michigan in the Manitowoc to Sheboygan neighborhood. You can learn more about Project Aquarius and what they're finding this Saturday at the Wisconsin Maritime Museum in Manitowoc. Chris will be leading a talk about the team's efforts starting at 12:30. There is an admission fee. Museum members can get in for free. Details at wisconsinmaritime.org. Coming up, it's the dangerous predator, the mosquito. I'm Rob Ferret. This is Central Time on the Ideas Network. You're listening to Central Time. I'm Rob Ferret. Coming up tomorrow at 6 on The Morning Show, join Kate Archer-Kent and her guest for a preview of the Democratic presidential candidate debate. That's tomorrow morning at 6 here on the Ideas Network. Now, one of the biggest annoyances of summer in Wisconsin are the constant swarms of mosquitoes. Summer is short in the state, and while we're eager to get outside and enjoy those fleeting moments of beautiful weather, mosquitoes can have a way of forcing us back inside. Here, they're mostly just a nuisance, but our next guest says that throughout history, these pests have been a lot more deadly than we might think. Because they carry potentially fatal diseases, mosquitoes are responsible for the deaths of billions of humans throughout history, making them the deadliest predator of people that the world has ever seen. In a new book, our guest explains how mosquitoes have changed the course of human history from ancient times to present day. Timothy Weingart is a professor of history and political science at Colorado Mesa University and author of the new book, The Mosquito, A Human History of Our Deadliest Predator. Timothy, thanks a lot for joining us today.
Of course. Thanks for having me.
Well, what made you want to explore this topic that historians might not necessarily be expected to pursue?
Well, I look at history as a puzzle almost, and there were various pieces that fit together to make a clear picture of the devastation and historical influence of this tiny little animal throughout our existence and across our history. Part of my other books in military history and looking at indigenous people, my past four books, I kept coming across references to malaria specifically and yellow fever and dengue. So I was familiar with some of the devastation wrought by the mosquito, but as I got down the rabbit hole and started further into the research, it became very apparent, and as I said, fit more puzzle pieces together, just how influential this tiny creature and universal creature has been in steering the course of human history.
And you write that in military history and in other fields of history, the topic of disease and mosquito-borne disease in particular, it's often kind of overlooked or a footnote, when in fact it should be, you say, front and center.
Well, yeah, up until the First World War, 65% of deaths during times of war were caused by disease. That included, obviously, malaria and yellow fever, depending on the wars and the campaigns, but also dysentery was a huge killer, influenza, smallpox, so various diseases. But people, journalists find, you know, disease rather dull when compared to our national supermen, which are most often legendary military heroes. So unfortunately, the history has been a bit tainted by, you know, ascribing victories or the rise and fall of empires and nations to human agency instead of outside factors. In this case, the mosquito has been paramount in dictating the course of numerous wars. And also the rise and fall of specific nations, including the United States.
Let's touch on the biology a little bit before we dig more into the history. When a mosquito lands on us, she is getting our blood. And it's always she, right?
Correct. Only females bite. The male's world essentially revolves around reproduction and nectar. The female, she's just doing what she's programmed to do, which is procreate and carry on her species, and she needs the blood of humans and a zoological Noah's Ark of other animals. It's not just humans. It's a wide variety of animals she needs blood from simply to grow and mature her eggs and do what she's programmed to do, which is procreate and carry on her species.
And with her comes a lot of diseases, of various forms, virus, bacteria, protozoa, have evolved to use the mosquito as part of their own reproductive systems. Why is the mosquito such a convenient vector for them?
Well, obviously, as you mentioned, Rob, the mosquito, untethered from a pathogen, is harmless. It's the pathogens that she transmits that are the killers and cause so much death and suffering and misery. So there's a host of viruses. There's three classes. There's viruses, worms, and then protozoan or malaria. The parasite is in its own class. So the virus class consists of yellow fever, dengue, Zika, West Nile, chikungunya, and a host of others. And then the worm category is filariasis, which causes the engorgement of limbs and genitals. And it's a worm that kind of blocks the lymph system in the lymph nodes, the filarial worm. And still 120 million people annually contract filariasis. Similar in canines, canine heartworm is actually caused by the mosquito as well. And then the parasite or protozoan class is malaria. And it's been the scourge of humanity across our existence. And it is the paramount killer, as well as yellow fever in the virus class. But thankfully, a vaccine was put forth in the 1930s for yellow fever. So only roughly 25,000 to 40,000 people still die of yellow fever annually, which is far less than it used to be, thanks to the vaccine.
Talking to Timothy Weingard, author of the new book, The Mosquito, A Human History of Our Deadliest Predator. I want to go back to pre-human. We're newcomers here. The mosquito, you write, has been around for, 130 million years, and they were a nuisance and a cause of disease and possibly death for dinosaurs.
Yeah, depending on the estimates, the consensus is generally mosquitoes show up during the early Jurassic period, which is roughly 200 to 190 million years ago. Now, some estimates push them back as far as 225 million years ago, but regardless of the estimates, they were around during the reign of the dinosaurs. And prior to the meteor hitting our planet just outside the Yucatan Peninsula, leaving a crater the size of roughly Vermont, the state of Vermont, sandflies, mosquitoes, and other insects were feeding on dinosaurs for the same reasons they feed on animals today, to get blood to reproduce, and passing on viruses, worms, and parasites just like they do today. So it's theorized that roughly 70% of regional species on the planet, dinosaur species, were either extinct or endangered by the time the meteor actually hits, which essentially finishes the dinosaurs off.
And fast forwarding to humans, mosquitoes didn't just affect our history. We're going to spend more of our time on that. They actually shaped our evolution in some ways. We evolved in different places, different times, genetic reactions over generations to the diseases carried by mosquitoes.
In Africa, there's five kinds of malaria that affect humans, and the two most, I guess, prevalent in Africa and the most lethal are vivax and falciparum. So there's various genetic hereditary evolutionary responses that were essentially pushed forward by natural selection. Now, falciparum is the most deadly form of the five human malarias, and sickle cell was our response, essentially, through natural selection to combat what must have been such a survival pressure on our species, our early species in Africa, to have such a faulty evolutionary response, if you will. But what it speaks to is what must have been horrific and genocidal rates of falciparum malaria in Africa. So sickle cell, our red blood cells are generally oval or donut shaped, and sickle cell is a genetic mutation which makes our red blood cells sickle or crescent shaped. So the malaria parasite can't actually latch on to the blood cell. It fools it. It can't latch on to feed on the hemoglobin inside the blood cell and obviously giving us symptoms and making us sick. Now, the problem with sickle cell is it's a very hasty evolutionary response. If you inherit sickle cell from both parents, which is sickle cell disease, it's essentially a death sentence. And if you inherit sickle cell from one parent but a normal cell from the other, it's called sickle cell anemia or sickle cell trait. Now, it offers roughly a 90% shield against falciparum malaria, but at the same time, the average lifespan with sickle cell trait prior to modern medicine was about 23 years. But that's certainly long enough to procreate and carry on the human species and also pass on the sickle cell trait to your offspring. So it's a very hasty evolutionary response to what must have been cataclysmic death rates from falciparum malaria in Africa.
Well, let's get into the heart of your book now, the mosquitoes and human history. Alexander the Great conquered a lot of the known world. You say he stopped and ultimately maybe died because of mosquito-borne illness. Can you tell us about that?
Well, when he crosses the Hindu Kush in Pakistan and continues east towards India, he starts his eastern push in the monsoon season along the Indus River Valley system. And mosquitoes had long been actually fingered by Indian physicians before that as a cause of disease. If not the mosquitoes, then the water that they bred in, according to the miasma theory. So it wasn't new that mosquitoes and malaria inhabited that area. So when he comes, towards that push into the east towards India, there's a few factors at play here. The rebellion or open mutiny of his troops is a little bit exaggerated. His troops were suffering from all sorts of diseases, including malaria. They'd been warring for years. They were tired. Alexander was more reliant on mercenaries by this point than he was on Greeks or Macedonians. And he had a perfect 20-0 battle record. In his next conquests were huge empires that had numerous war elephants that scared the Macedonian horses. So when his troops passed up their grievances up the chain of command and said they wanted to return west, he didn't appear to protest with any great zeal. And again, malaria was one factor in the decision and the weakening of Alexander's army in the Indus River system. And ultimately, he decided to turn back because of these compounding issues he was facing. And then on his way back, he stopped in Babylon to plan his campaigns, which included another eastern push. We don't know 100% because his body's gone missing, but the likely cause of Alexander's death is malaria. There's other causes that have been put forward, but malaria is the consensus, but we can't be 100% sure because his body is missing in action, essentially.
We're talking right now with Timothy Weingard, professor of history and political science, author of the new book, The Mosquito, A Human History of Our Deadliest Predator. You can join in at 800-642-1234. What questions do you have about mosquitoes, the diseases they carry, and our guest focus in his book, how they have affected human history? Do you wonder about the role they've played at different times in American history? We're going to get into that in just a bit. And if we could eradicate mosquitoes, should we? Call 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234 or email ideas@WPR.org. We'll pick up the conversation coming up on Central Time. This is Central Time. I'm Rob Ferret. We continue our conversation with Timothy Weingard, professor of history and political science, author of the new book, The Mosquito, A Human History of Our Deadliest Predator. You can join in at 800-642-1234. Do you have a question about the mosquito and how it's influenced human history? Have you ever been in a place that had a lot of malaria? Have you had malaria yourself? If you'd care to share the story, call in 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234. Timothy, you have chapters about American history there. Can you tell us how mosquito-borne illnesses, mainly malaria and yellow fever, affected the rise of slavery here in the United States?
Well, and initially when European colonizers come to the Americas, they need slave labor on their plantations, specifically in the Caribbean, but also in the lower American colonies as well. And so at first they tried to enslave indigenous peoples of the Americas, but the indigenous population, unfortunately, is not immune to these new European diseases that are brought with the Europeans. So upwards of 95 million of the 100 million indigenous peoples across the Western Hemisphere die within the first 200 years of Columbus, primarily of disease. So they're no longer really a feasible option for a slave labor economic system and a mercantilist system with these plantation colonies, specifically in the Caribbean, South Central America, and also the lower American colonies. So European indentured servants are then tried, but in these hot tropical places with mosquito-borne disease, they can't withstand the mosquito-borne disease. So part of the reason Africans are so valued in the Caribbean, which is a hotbed of malaria and yellow fever, is that they have, some of them have these genetic immunities to malaria, whether that be sickle cell, thalassemia, Duffy antigen negativity, and also they've been seasoned to yellow fever and survived yellow fever, which is a virus, in Africa itself, making them essentially inoculated or immune to yellow fever. So where indigenous peoples and European indentured servants are dying in droves in these furnace of mosquito-borne disease in the lower American South and the Caribbean, African slaves seem to withstand her wrath to more of an extent because of these hereditary shields to malaria and also the prior seasoning to yellow fever. So it's an unfortunate part of, I guess, the mosquitoes, influence of history, obviously, because the African slave trade is one of the most horrific events in human history.
And then the Civil War, malaria and yellow fever end up playing a role there. Can you talk about that?
Well, American Civil War is a two-pronged mosquito influence, if you will. So at the beginning of the war, specifically 1862, the Union forces coming from the north, obviously, where there is not endemic malaria, there are certain epidemics of malaria in the northern states, but not to the extent that malaria exists or is endemic across the Confederacy. So what happens is the Union launches assaults into Confederate territory in 1862, specifically against Vicksburg, against the Mississippi, along the Mississippi River. And there, those forces are cut to pieces by malaria. And then General McClellan's Peninsula Campaign in between the York and James Rivers, which is essentially marshland, to try to capture Richmond in 1862 as well. And his troops suffer greatly from malaria. And obviously both campaigns fail in 1862, prolonging the war in what was supposed to be a short war, allowing Lincoln to add another war aim on top of just preserving the Union, which included the economic integrity of the United States. By 1863, because the war is prolonged with the failure of these campaigns in 1862, Lincoln adds the emancipation of slaves and the abolition of slavery as another primary war aim. And in the final year of the war, quinine, which is the anti-malarial of the time period, the Anaconda Plan, which is the Union naval blockade and stranglehold of the Confederacy, really starts to take effect. And the Confederacy is short, drastically short of all supplies, which includes quinine. And just to give you an idea, by 1865, an ounce of quinine cost $600 in the Confederacy, which speaks to, the small quantities of quinine, but also its demand in the Confederacy, whereas the Union is absolutely stockpiled with quinine. So in the final year of the war, you start to see malaria rot away the combat effectiveness of the Confederate forces, whereas the malaria rates in the Union are less because of their stockpiles of quinine.
Talking to Timothy Weingard, author of the new book, The Mosquito, A Human History of Our Deadliest Predator. Let's bring on a caller now. Tim is with us in Marinette. Tim, hi.
Hi. Yeah, I just wanted to let Timothy know that I had recently read about a young scientist, a professor in electrical engineering, that had invented some kits, plastic kits he made, that if you put body fluid on them, they'll detect diseases with a smartphone, things like malaria, dung fever, they'll test water quality, and he's thinking about these third world countries where, you know, they're hundreds or thousands of miles away from a lab. And these kits, they're little plastic kits.
Interesting.
That are cheap, and they detect nanoparticles with gold receptors.
Tim, thanks a lot for the call. And Timothy, that speaks to malaria is not just a force in human history, it's a force in human nowadays. Can you talk about malaria in the world of 2019?
Well, the mosquito is still far and away our deadliest predator, and that includes humans. It's number one, and humans are a distant second, and creatures of Hollywood lore like sharks and wolves are way down the list, roughly 10 deaths a year on average caused by those animals. So Hollywood's got it completely wrong. I don't see them making horror movies about mosquitoes quite yet, but it's by still far and away our deadliest predator. And malaria is unfortunately the pervasive killer. Now, there's good news and bad news. Progressively since the year 2000, and certainly due in part to the wonderful efforts of the Bill and Melinda Gates Foundation, we've seen malaria rates be reduced across the world every year. So malaria rates are falling every year, which is certainly a good thing. But on the other hand, what we're seeing is the emergence or reemergence of other mosquito-borne diseases. Now, thankfully, these aren't as prolific killers as malaria is. But so, for example, dengue is making a huge comeback, West Nile, Zika. So we're seeing the emergence or reemergence of other mosquito-borne diseases while malaria rates are certainly falling. So it's kind of a double-edged sword. In fact, I was reading a few articles the other day that said 4 billion people on the planet currently are at risk of dengue alone. And that's more than half the population. There's roughly 7.7, 7.8 billion people on the planet. So when you think 4 billion people are at risk of dengue alone, that's quite shocking. And that doesn't include all the other diseases. So it's a bit of a spider web. So malaria rates reduced, but emerging and other re-emerging mosquito-borne diseases are on the increase, including the southern United States, where we've seen domestic cases of Zika, dengue, and chikungunya in Florida and Texas in recent years. So it is a concern, and the mosquito is generally a universal animal. Then she inhabits every corner of the planet except for Iceland and Antarctica. So it's a universal creature with becoming universal diseases, and it requires a universal solution at the end of the day.
And Timothy, I want to touch on one more story you tell. We thought we had a solution called DDT. There were a lot of environmental concerns about its indiscriminate use. But why did we stop using DDT on large scales against mosquitoes?
Well, DDT, if we for a second just put aside the environmental degradation and its effects on other animals, including humans, and its you know, cancer agents and cancer causing of human beings, if we just look at DDT that was, you know, tried, tested, and true coming out of the Second World War, it was a miraculous mosquito killer. Mosquito-borne disease rates were slashed across the planet with the use of DDT, and it certainly saved countless lives. The problem is, depending on the mosquito species, they evolved and adapted very quickly, anywhere from 2 years to 20 years, to become immune to DDT. So by the time Rachel Carson writes and publishes her seminal work, Silent Spring, in 1962, there's mosquito populations across the planet that are already immune to DDT. So the banning of DDT has more to do with its ineffective use against mosquitoes than anything Rachel Carson wrote or some environmental political clout. It just simply didn't work anymore. And what's also important to mention about DDT is it was made commercially available to farmers in 1946. It wasn't the surgical use of DDT with residual spraying against mosquitoes that created such environmental problems. It was the actual carpet, you know, blanketing of the planet, or as Joni Mitchell says, paving paradise with DDT from an agricultural standpoint, that created so much environmental problems to other animals, including human beings. But it just simply didn't work anymore.
Timothy, we'll leave it there. Thanks so much for sharing these stories with us today.
Of course. Thank you for having me.
That's Timothy Weingard, professor of history and political science at Colorado Mesa University, author of the new book we've been talking about, The Mosquito, A Human History of Our Deadliest Predator. Coming up tomorrow on Central Time, we're 10 years out from a low point in the Great Recession. The author of two books on personal finance looks at consumer protection and financial security and whether anything has really changed since the collapse. That and more coming up tomorrow here on Central Time. Weekdays from 6 to 9 a.m., it's The Morning Show with Kate Archer Kent. Tomorrow at 7, Kate talks to a UW researcher who's working with low-dose psychedelic drugs as a possible treatment for some people with depression. That's tomorrow at 7 on The Morning Show. Coming up next, it's news from NPR and Wisconsin Public Radio. Then we'll talk about Marquette University's protest policy, how it fits into broader free speech issues on college campuses, and possible revisions to that policy already on the way after some pushback from faculty and students. I'm Rob Ferret. You're listening to Central Time here on the Ideas Network.